I'll tell you something I love about being in France, in addition to some seriously delicious butter, and that is the wide selection of wines I can find in France for low prices. It can be much more difficult to source those same bottles back in the States, and that's why I love to buy wines out of France with Ideal Wine. I have bottles shipped to me, hassle-free. It's easy. Ideal Wine has a new auction every week and is a great source for iconic names like Ouette, Louis Roeder, and Domaine Lefleuve, as well as rising stars like Arnaud Lachaud, Gonon, and Tissot. Find the wines you'd rather be drinking at idealwine.com. That's IDEALWINE.com and have the wine shipped to you in the States. Use the promo code FIRST, FIRST, for $15 off your first order of $150 or more. Hey, that's $15 you could save, and that is some good butter money. See for yourself at Ideal Wine.
I'll Drink to That, where we get behind the scenes of the beverage business. I'm Levy Dalton.
I'm Erin Scala.
And here's our show today. Christian Seeley of AXA Milzim, the managing director on the show today. Hello, sir. How are you?
I'm very well. Good to see you.
Very nice to have you here.
Thank you.
So you're actually British, although you haven't spent a whole lot of time there recently.
No, I was born in Nottingham in England, and I was educated and brought up in England. But for the last 23 years, I've been living outside England, in Portugal and in France, mostly in the Douro Valley and in Bordeaux.
What was the first introduction to wine?
My first introduction to wine was probably illegally young, because my dad was a great wine lover and Francophile, and he used to write a lot about wine. He wrote books about wine. He was a journalist. And so our house was just full of wine, and he used to love sharing his wine with anybody, but I was around more than most people, and so he shared a lot of wine with me, and so I got to taste some wonderful wines with him from an extremely young age, and it was a wonderful experience to discover wine in that way with someone who knew what they were talking about and could explain what it was I was discovering.
What was your dad like?
Completely in love with the whole business of winemaking and all that wine meant. You might say he was someone dedicated to the idea that life should be fun, and he spent most of his life having fun, and an awful lot of it having fun with wine. And I learned that approach to life from him. And one has to work as well. But in the end, this job of making wine, which is what I do today, you can take it as seriously as you like or as not seriously as you like. But in the end, what it's all about, what we're trying to do when we make a bottle of wine, wherever it is we're making it, is make something that is going to give people pleasure. And I never forget that. When I'm in a vineyard in the Douro, in Bordeaux, the one thing I always bear in mind is that everything we do is geared to the final moment, maybe some years down the line, when somebody somewhere is going to open a bottle and have a good moment with some friends.
Hopefully me.
Well, sometimes me too. It's one of the things that inspires me the most in the job I do, which is looking after vineyards and making wine, is the thought that all over the world there are literally thousands of people who one day are going to have pleasure, I hope, opening some of the bottles that we're making.
And your dad wrote some books about wine.
Yeah, he wrote a few books. Bordeaux was his big love, but not only. He wrote about the Loire Valley, he wrote about South African wines, and he was a journalist writing about wines generally. He loved the product, and unusually, I think, he had a great respect for the people who devote their lives to looking after vineyards. He was a farmer himself originally. His family were farmers, and I don't think he ever forgot the farming side of it. And so whenever I visited quite a few vineyards with him, and I noticed that he was always very interested to walk in the vineyards, meet with the people who actually spend their time growing the grapes. And that's something I've never forgotten. And in the vineyards that I look after, I try not to forget that however grand the chateau, however grate the wine. It all depends on what goes on out there. That's a kind of cliche, but the people who prune the vines, look after the vines, look after the grapes, without them, those wines never get in the bottle.
So did you end up ever helping your father on any of his wine-related ventures?
Yeah, I did. Only one, but when I left university, I read the English literature at Cambridge and spent 3 years wandering around reading poems and looking at the clouds and having a very good time generally. And I left university and discovered that there weren't that many jobs available to people whose speciality was reading poems. And
looking at clouds, however.
Looking at
big
clouds,
market.
Big market. So I wasn't quite sure what to do. My dad said, well, while you're trying to make up your mind, I'm just off to Bordeaux for 6 months and I'm going to write a book. I did speak French. And he said, you can come, you can translate, you can do historical research, you can work with me. And above all, you can come to all the tastings and we'll have a great time. Having a great time was really the principal aim of his life. And that's something I've inherited. So I thought, yes, this sounds like a great time. And so I did it. So I spent those 6 months in Bordeaux having a great time with my dad. And it was a memorable time, but it was also the most extraordinary discovery and learning experience.
How so? I mean, what happened?
Well, the program was, sounds like a program that's just all about having fun, but it was also quite hard work. We would visit usually two chateaus a day, and we would visit in the morning one chateau, taste the last 10 vintages of that chateau. Normally we'd be invited to lunch, the proprietor would open a few older bottles, and then we'd get into our car, and then we'd drive to the next appointment, be another chateau, we'd taste 10 vintages, and then they would normally invite us to dinner, and they would open a few old vintages. And that process would just continue for at least 5 days a week for over a period of several months. After a few days of this, I thought, you know, I like this life. This is just how life should be. It was intensely enjoyable, but as I said, a very concentrated learning experience, because even though I had very little tasting experience, really, apart from just drinking a few good bottles with my dad before, I was 22 when this happened. When you do a tasting experience like that for 6 months, after a few days, you begin to compare, contrast, and to understand. You know, tasting is all about doing it and thinking about it. You know, you have got to enjoy it. But above all, you have to have the experience. And so it was a fantastic, concentrated experience that was one of the forming things in my career as in wine, I guess.
Must have been a kind of a cultural moment for Bordeaux. That's the 80s, right? I mean, you must have seen a generational shift.
Everything was changing. You know, it was the perfect time for my dad to write a book. But looking back on it, I think you're right. It was a key moment because it was 1983. Naturally, they'd just had the 82 vintage. It was the beginning of the time when Bordeaux began to get prosperous, because before then, for the preceding 40 years or so, most Grand Cru properties weren't actually making any money, and people were struggling. 82 vintage was an extraordinary success. The world interest, particularly the beginning of US consumers' interest in Grand Cru Bordeaux, boosted the demand and boosted the prices, although they were still pretty low in those days compared to what they are now. But it began to make growing grapes and making wine in Bordeaux at the Grand Cru level began to make it profitable. Because it was profitable, people were able to devote themselves to it and they were able to invest. So I think that time, 83, was an extraordinary moment to visit Bordeaux, because it was the beginning of a period of change. And I think a period that has been entirely positive for Bordeaux and for wine lovers, because the quality of what's coming out today has got nothing to do with what was being made then.
These days, you run several Bordeaux chateaux, including Petit Village and Pichon Baron. But how did that happen? I mean, you ended up going to Portugal for a number of years and overseeing that. So what was the segue there?
It's very nice to go and visit Bordeaux with my dad as a writer's assistant. It's not obvious, even if you decide, I love this world, I want to be in it, the next step is actually getting into it. And you know, I scratched my head a while and thought, how can I get into this wonderful world? And my first thought was go back to England and get a job, make lots of money, and buy yourself a vineyard. I was thinking with the simple clarity of a 23-year-old. And So I went back to England. I started a business. I went to business school. I got a job in venture capital. I was doing pretty well, doing company turnarounds. But, you know, the years were going on, not many, many years. But even so, I thought, I'm never going to make enough money to buy one of the properties that I liked the look of when I was in Bordeaux. So this business of getting into it is going to be more difficult than I think. And then I heard that AXA Millésime, which was at the time run by Jean-Michel Caz of L'Anchepage, had bought Quinta de Noval, which I knew. It was one of the properties that my dad loved, and we had Quinta de Noval ports at home, and I had some. I had some Quinta de Noval 70 vintage at the time. I had a case and a few bottles left. And anyway, I knew that Noval had gone through a very bad period in the 70s and 80s.
Is that true? There was a little bit of a dip there.
It was you could call it a dip. The 70s were a dip, and the 80s were a big dip. And Noval, which had been, you know, famous from the 1920s right to the end of the 60s for making some of the most stellar vintage ports, some of the most beautiful vintage ports that were made during that period, did go into a sort of 20-year decline from 1970 onwards. And, I knew that story. And I knew that Noval had been sold to AXA Millésime because it was in financial difficulties. And so I wrote a letter to Mr. Caz and I said, well, you've just bought one of the most beautiful vineyards in the world. It's one of the great vineyards, but it needs turning round. And my job at the moment is turning round businesses. I've never run a vineyard, but I'm not afraid of difficult situations. I can imagine it might be quite complicated and difficult to turn this round, but I would love to have an interview with you to discuss the possibilities of doing it, because wine has always been my passion. And Jean-Michel Caz, you know, I thank him forever that he is a great man with a very entrepreneurial spirit. He got the letter and agreed to see me. And so I had a first interview with him, and we got on extremely well. And I think the first interview, he was probably just seeing me just out of curiosity and politeness. And then we had another one, and then we had a much longer one. And then he offered me the job of being managing director of Quinta de Noval. And the brief was to turn it round. So Noval, when I took it on in 1993 as MD of Noval, was losing a lot of money. It was more or less broke. And its reputation had gone quite downhill, and it hadn't been making great wines for a long time. So the brief I had was to polish up the jewel, if you like, and get Noval back to making great wine again and make it profitable again. And so I had a wonderful experience, age 32, of having one of the great vineyards of the world in my hands with a great boss, which was Jean-Michel Caz, who was the chairman of the thing, and with a shareholder who knew that in order to make it work, they had to invest. So I had everything was in place, and really all I had to do was make sure that I had a good team of people behind me and start looking after the vineyard properly and start making great wines again and start selling them, and things would go well. And they did. So after a few years, Noval was, you know, back on course and starting to make great wines again, and was back in profit. So it was a wonderful experience. I'm forever grateful to Noval, actually, because I remember the very first day I went there. I was left on my own there for a day, and for various reasons, and I just spent a day walking around it. And
you were left on your own? Does that mean the staff just left? They were just like, we're scared of this guy.
No, I don't mean that, but I was there with Jean-Michel Caz, and he had to go back to Porto for something or other, and he said, well, you just stay at Noval for the day. And I said, yeah, I'd be delighted. So I just wandered around.
Let's be clear, was there electricity and stuff? I mean, this is like upriver.
Yeah,
like,
it was
were all, there working facilities?
It was pretty basic in those days. You know, there was one telephone.
I saw this movie. It was called Cape Fear. And it look a little, you know.
But that day was a very special day for me, and I'll never forget it, because I just spent the day wandering around this vineyard, and I thought, you know, this is a very special place. Noval is the kind of place where anybody who comes there, and I've had it many times with people coming, they've realized there is something unique, special, and magical about this vineyard. And I felt it as I was walking around it. And I was thinking, you need a bit of love and attention at the moment, because the vineyard was not in a good state. And it was one of the things that made me decide to actually take the job that, that Jean-Michel Cars actually offered me, because I wasn't sure at that stage whether I, whether it was, you know, sensible to just take off into the middle of Portugal and change my life completely. And I basically fell in love with the place then, and that hasn't changed. And so ever since then, I've done my best to look after it.
And why do you think Jean-Michel Cars picked you? I mean, what did he see in you, do you think?
We got on very well, and you know, he's someone who's a good judge of people. If you manage businesses well, and he always did, you just have to work out whether you have to pick someone who just might, for various combinations of reasons, be the person who's going to do the job you want them to do. And that's, I guess he must have made that decision. Anyway, I did my best ever afterwards to justify that. And in any case, once I'd got stuck in at Noval, the initial falling in love that happened on my first day there became a very intense affair. And, you know, I just devoted myself to the place. And I still do. Anyone who's had the experience of running a vineyard will know that you can establish this sort of relationship with the place. And I'm very conscious of the fact that you're just a servant of the place, basically. Whether you've inherited it or whether you've just got the job of running it, you should be aware that you're part of something that is much bigger than you, that's existed for a long time before you and is going to go on existing a long time after you. And you're just a little blip in the history of the place. But what you can try and do is, you know, just do a good job of looking after this very special thing that is in your hands for this period of time. Obviously, I like the period of time to be as long as possible. I've been there for 22 years now. I hope to be there for as long as possible.
So what were your first moves? I mean, you get there, you look around, you realize that some revitalization is necessary. How do you go about things?
Well, I guess the first thing that I did when I arrived was to form the team around me. And that meant some people who were there before were no longer there, because inevitably, if something's gone wrong, there are a few people who might have been part of the reason why it went wrong. And so those people get to go. That's the ruthless part. And then there will be very good people in the team who might have, well, there were very good people in the team who loved the vineyard, loved Noval, and were very frustrated by the idea that it wasn't going so well. And those people, once you identify them, you can promote them up and give them the chance to participate in the renaissance of the thing that they love. And then you recruit a few other people from the outside who will join that project. So basically, you asked me what's the first thing. The first thing is forming the team, and that might take about a year. But forming the team of people who share a vision of what we want to do, which is basically, it's not a very complicated vision. You've got one of the greatest vineyards in the world, capable of making one of the greatest wines in the world, which no longer was at the time that we took it over. And the vision was clear: get it back to making great wine again. And it was losing money. Get it back to making profits. That's any business, if you're losing money, it's not going to work. You've got to make it profitable so that it can be sustainable and so that you can carry on doing what you're doing. And of course, if it's a wine business, and it's, if you've got a vineyard in your hands capable of making one of the great wines of the world, well, you've got a responsibility to make sure it makes as great a wine as it possibly can. And you don't do those things on your own. Probably the most important thing I did, apart from formulating the desire of what we wanted to do and providing a little bit of the willpower, perhaps, to make it happen, was recruiting a team of people who had the technical competence to do what was necessary in the vineyard and the cellars to make Noval great again. And so together, that's what we then proceeded to do.
And set the stage for me a little bit. I mean, it is one vineyard.
Yes. Quinta de Noval is unique in the world of port because it's the only one of the traditional port shippers whose image is totally centered on the image of a vineyard. Quinta de Noval does have its own special identity. It's this vineyard-based port shipper and very much vineyard-based vintage port. And it's really important because if you taste a Quinta de Noval vintage port today, the most recent, the great vintage that I've been while I've been responsible for Noval was the 2011. And I think it's one of the most beautiful vintages that we've ever had at Quinton Noval. And when you taste the young 2011, if you know the old vintages, things like the 66 or the 55, which are from the great period of Noval, you can just, of course, it's completely different. The other ones are 50 and 60 years old. But the 2011, you can catch little echoes of those great wines of the past, something in the style. And that's because the 2011 comes from the same place as the 55 and the 66 did.
And that place, it's on terraces, or is it planted a different way? Or?
It's 143 hectares. It's quite a big vineyard. It's on terraces. We have a little bit of vertical planting, but hardly any, because most of Noval is too steep for vertical planting. We've got a very high proportion of walled vineyards, you know, the old stone terraced walled vineyards. And this was something important that we did when we started in 1993. We did an awful lot of replanting of the vineyard. And at that time, when people were replanting vineyards, they tended to bulldoze the old stone walls in order to plant patamares, the terraces without walls, because it was cheaper and easier to mechanize. And we decided to keep all the old stone walls of Quinton Noval and replant the old walled vineyards and mechanize them. And this was actually the first time that had been done in the Douro. And it wasn't terribly complicated, but it was a little bit more complicated than just bulldozing them and doing patamares. But the end result was, it's a result I'm very proud of, because we kept those walls, which I think are part of the, you know, it's a sort of an inheritance that we got from previous generations of very hardworking people who built those walls. They're very beautiful. I think it's a very great shame whenever any one of them goes down. And we managed to preserve them and rebuild them sometimes. And so there's the aesthetic side of it. The practical side of it is that vineyards planted on stone-walled terraces, you get a much higher density of plantation, which actually is positive for quality. Patamares are very good, and you can make great wine from patamares, but you get a lower density and higher productivity per vine, which is it's a challenge to manage. And the stone walls are very good for the higher density. And then we actually managed to retain those traditional characteristics of stone walls and mechanize them at the same time.
So 143 hectare, I mean, there must be some variation in terms of place and elevation. And
yes, of course. It's almost always the case in the Douro that, because of the nature of the terrain, that if you've got a vineyard of any size at all, there's a variation in height. We go from just over 100 meters above sea level, which is about the level of the River Pignan, up to 450 meters above sea level. And that band, basically between 150 and 400 meters, is the high quality traditional band for letter A, great vineyard terroir, making the best vintage ports. And Noval is almost all in that band. And then geographically, there are three main chunks to Noval. There's one big parcel. The biggest one is in the Pignan Valley, which is a little valley that runs into the Douro River. And then on the other side of the hill behind Noval, we have a substantial bit of vineyard in another valley called the Roncin Valley, which is completely different in terms of climate and conditions. And indeed, the schistous rock is rather different in its formation and its character. And then we have another parcel, smaller but quite significant, on the other side of the hill, which overlooks the Douro River itself. So we've got three parcels overlooking three different rivers: one the Big Douro River, one the Pignan tributary, and one the Roncin tributary.
So it's all schist, but it's different kinds of schist depending on where you are.
Yes, I think in the Arctic Circle, the Inuit people have many different words for snow. And in the Douro, we don't actually have different words for schist, but we look at it and we think, yeah, that's different schist. You know, it is all schistous rock, but there are subtle variations in the color, the density of the stone, the hardness of the stone. And I'm sure that these differences do make important differences for the vines. But it's not only that. The makeup of the Douro, with these sort of winding, sinuous valleys, if it's winding and sinuous, it means that you have various different expositions to the north, to the east, to the south, to the west. You have different heights with different humidities, with different heats, and sometimes different rainfalls, because the rainfall can come from one side and not from the other. The difference in soil is important, of course, and it's a factor. The difference in tiny microclimates all over the property is enormously important. And that's part of the complexity that makes up the greatness of a Noval wine, because we're free to choose wines from those various areas. But there are certain years where, one part of the vineyard does very well and the other part does less well as well.
But are there, because you make a range of different kinds of port, whether it be tawny or vintage port or LBV or the new black label. So are there certain parcels that tend to go into certain lots year after year after year? Does a certain kind of parcel lend itself to a certain kind of expression regularly or no?
To a certain extent, that's true. There are one or two parcels where we can be pretty sure that in a good year, where all the weather circumstances are right, you're likely to have vintage quality wine. There are other parcels that don't usually give you the tannic structure that you're looking for in vintage, but can give wonderful, elegant, fine port that would be well chosen to become Collieta ports. So yes, there are a few parcels like that. But I have to say that most of the vineyard, it's not like that. They produce different kinds of wine every year. And sometimes they are on the tasting. We taste them blind first off. And so we're not allowing our knowledge of the terroir to dictate what we think about the wines. We taste them blind first. We taste them afterwards, knowing what they are as well. And we do blind knowing. And I think that's quite a good way, by the way, to taste wine, because sometimes it's useful to taste without knowing, and sometimes it's useful to taste when you do know. But there are some parcels that in some years will make beautiful vintage quality wines, and some years will make lighter, more delicate wines. And we think, yeah, that could be a tour. And sometimes they wouldn't, they might be just, good wines, very good wines that are not vintage or Collieta style, but can make good LBVs. It does vary. But the answer to your initial question is, yes, there are certain parcels that are consistent. Probably the majority of the vineyard, it depends on the year.
So are the grape varieties in different blocks? I assume you have different grape varieties, or are they interplanted? Is it somewhat more random?
We have some parcels that are interplanted. We've got some field blends in various areas of the vineyard. But most of Noval now is planted in blocks, and we use most of our vineyard is planted to the five or six noble grape varieties: Torriga Nacional, Torriga Franca, Tinto Caon, Tinta Barocca, Tinta Amarella, Tinta Orige, and Suzanne. There's about seven sort of identified noble varieties, and that's most of what we got. There are a few others in there and in among the reds, but that's mostly what it is.
What are the takeaways in dealing with those? Are some of them more difficult, more tricky than others?
Yes, they are. The trickiest of all, it seems to be a general rule, which is just how life works, I guess, that the one that not only in the Douro Valley, but the grape variety that gives you the highest potential quality is not going to be the easiest grape variety. And Torriga Nacional, which for me is the noblest and finest of all the varieties in the Douro, is probably the most difficult. It's extremely temperamental. During flowering, if there's the slightest difficult wet conditions, there are some grape varieties that can just flower away in difficult conditions. And with Torriga Nacional, if it gets a bit damp in the flowering time, you can end up not having any crop at all, which is always regrettable. And then Torriga Nacional, actually, curiously, doesn't, it suffers quite a lot from heat. If it's particularly hot and particularly dry, the leaves on the Torriga Nacional vine can be seriously affected. And then the yields are naturally low on Torriga Nacional. You're talking, there are certain varieties like Tinto Orige, which is a perfectly decent variety, but not so great, I think, in terms of quality, which would give you 40 to 45 hectolitres a hectare, more if you push it. And Torriga Nacional will give you about half that, 20 to 25 hectolitres a hectare. It makes a big difference when you're getting half as much from your vineyard. But the end result from Torriga Nacional can be sublime. And so it's worth all the trouble and all the risk. But it's probably the highest risk of all the varieties, I'd say, and the highest quality. And then there are others, you know, Tintoro Ridge is extremely reliable in terms of producing a good, steady yield and makes very decent wine, but never quite hits the heights, you know. So I think there's a good argument for having a good mix of grape varieties in your vineyard. But if you want a good proportion of Touriga Nacional, you've got to take the risk and plant it yourself.
When the grapes come into the winery and you start to ferment them, how do you separate the lots? Do you separate them by parcel or by grape variety or by when they're picked? Or
in most of Quinta Noval, the parcel is the grape variety because most of it is block planted. And in most cases, we will vinify the parcels separately. But sometimes we might decide to mix two parcels, which might be two grape varieties. If you have a parcel of Touriga Nacional planted next to a parcel of Touriga Franca, for example, you might easily decide to mix them in the, and you're picking them at the same time, you might decide to mix them in the Lagar and ferment them together. And that can work very well. And so we do both, really.
And what's it like foot stomping in a Lagar?
It's an extraordinary thing to experience and it's an extraordinary thing to see because most winemaking all over the world today is done in stainless steel vats in quite industrial sort of conditions, really. The temperature's controlled, everything is electronically controlled, and the results from that kind of winemaking are absolutely great. And that's, you know, part of human progress. But thousands of years ago, the way that men made wine was, you know, it's pretty basic. You pick the grapes, you stomp them with your feet, probably in some kind of stone trough, and then you wait for it to start fermenting. And when it's finished, that's the wine. And I'm making winemaking sound a little easier than it is, but that was certainly how it must have started. And in the Douro Valley, it hasn't changed much because when you make port wine, I'm only talking about the relatively small number of great port wine quintas that have serious ambitions to make great vintage port. But all of them, I think almost without exception, make their wines in lagars because it has been shown to be the best way to make high-quality wines. At any rate, at Quinta de Noval, 100% of the port wine from our quinta is made in lagars. And what happens is we pick the grapes during the day, we bring them in, we put them in these stone troughs, which are like quite large granite paddling pools, which come up to about mid-thigh on a human leg. And then in the evening, we have a team of people who would go in and tread those grapes for about 3.5 hours with bare feet, bare legs. And then around 11:30, they get out and they go to bed. And what's left is a perfectly crushed must. Sometime over the next 12 hours, that will start to ferment because there are yeasts on the outside skins of the grapes. There's sugars inside the grape, and once they've been crushed, the two come into contact and fermentation will start. And it's completely natural. We use just natural yeasts that occur in the vineyard. And once the fermentation has started, within about 48 hours, half of those natural sugars have fermented into alcohol, and half of the natural, roughly half the natural fruit sugars remain in the must. At that point, we interrupt the fermentation by adding very pure, very neutral grape spirit, in a proportion of about 20% to 80% must. And that's it. You draw off the wine and we've made our port. So it's absolutely not technological winemaking. It is as basic as winemaking can be. It's one of the reasons I love port, partly because of the rather romantic idea that you're in touch with the way that human beings made wine thousands of years ago because, you know, they didn't used to have stainless steel vats, but they sure did have stone troughs and peat, and that's how we make it. So we're still doing it that way, and the results are pretty good. And that's an attractive idea in itself. And the other thing that I love about it is that, for me, it's the absolute perfect proof of the idea that a wine is great not because of anything particularly clever that we do in the winery. Nothing technical, nothing, no fancy tricks, no fancy technology. If you've got a great vintage port, the only reason it's great is because you've got a great piece of vineyard with great grapes that you've looked after well, and you've brought them into those lagars in perfect condition, and then you just stomp them correctly, and that's about it. And so port will be great because of the place it comes from and because of the quality of the grapes that go in. And you get a lot of winemakers who say, oh, it's all about the vineyard. It's a kind of a cliche for winemakers to say it. And of course, it's true. But with port, you see it really demonstrated in the most literal way, because the only way you can make it great is to make sure you've got great grapes coming out of your vineyard, because afterwards you're just treading it, and there's not much fancy trickery after that. You know.
So at what point do you start to determine where those lots are going to go? When do you start to decide, oh, well, this could be a vintage port or this could be a tawny port?
You might have an idea quite soon, because one of the enjoyable things about port wine winemaking is that you've got a finished wine remarkably quickly. Within 3 days of the grapes being picked and brought to the lagars, the wine is more or less finished, and you can taste it. And it's in a barrel, and it's starting its life of aging off. So you can actually taste the wines, and we do very regularly throughout the harvest, because of course harvest lasts for 6 weeks, and there are many 3 day cycles of making port wine in the lagars, and we're tasting the wines constantly during that period. And so obviously, if you're tasting the wines every day, you notice variations in style and character. Of course, it's too soon to determine anything, but you can have ideas. You know, you taste wine and you think, wow, that's got some really big tannic structure. That I think this is going to be a great wine, perhaps for a vintage port. And then you might taste another and find it has this sort of wonderful, delicate elegance. And you think, this is what I'd like to see for a tawny. But at that stage, it's just suppositions in your mind. The real decision doesn't happen for at least a year afterwards.
One of the things with Noval is that it seems that several of the declared vintages for vintage port also match up with declared vintages for tawny port, Collieta tawny ports. And so that seems to imply that maybe a great year is a great year, or am I reading that wrong?
No, I think that's perfectly right. The reason why that's possible is, I think it's important to remember that vintage port is a wine of selection. We don't make it every year, and when we do decide to make it, it represents a tiny percentage of the total amount of port we've made in that year. Could be something like 5 or 6%, sometimes quite a bit less, of our total production of port in that year. So that means that there's a whole lot of extremely good port we made in that very good year that is not going into the vintage port blend. And if we declare a Collieta, it might represent just 1% of our total production. So supposing that 5% of your production has gone into your vintage port blend and 1% has gone into your Collieta blend, well, you know, that you've just taken the top 6% of your production in a very great year. There's no reason why you can't do that. And we do. That's exactly what we do. But sometimes, you know, when we don't declare a vintage year, you can have some absolutely delicious wines that would not be of vintage style that could easily make Collietas. So sometimes you can make a Collieta in not a vintage year as well.
When you follow those two things, because now you've been doing it for more than 2 decades, so I feel like you've have some perspective to look back. When you follow a vintage port and a Collieta port from the same year, how do you find that the characteristics differ in the glass? I mean, obviously one has a certain kind of, you know, more oxidative note and the fruit's dried, and the other has more primary fruit. But besides that, what is reflected in a Collieta tawny of significant age and wood and from the same year, what is reflected in the vintage?
I love doing this, and I very the two that I serve probably the most often at the moment would be the 2000 vintage port Quinta de Noval and the 2000 Collieta, both of which I love. I think 2000 was one of the great years that we've had in the last 2 decades, and I think slightly underestimated, actually, I, because people made more noise about 97 and about 94, but I absolutely love 2000. So I often serve the two together, and they really are very, very different now. When they started their life, they were both wines made in lagars, look pretty similar. They might have had slightly different styles at the beginning. You might have had a little bit more tannic concentration in the vintage and a little bit more of the finesse on the wines that went in to make the Coglieta. But really, you're talking about tiny nuances, and the wines would have looked the same. Very dark red, young port with lots of primary fruit. And that's how they would have started their lives. As you say, the vintage port retains, I think forever, a lot of those primary fruit characteristics because it's being aged in the bottle and not in contact with oxygen. And tawny port just develops in a different way. And it's really like two wines that start off almost the same go off in two completely different directions. And it shows how important the way you age a wine can be to the final product you get. And some people prefer vintage style, some people prefer old tawny style. And I've never understood why you have to prefer one or the other. I think it's absolutely perfect to have both. I love both. And they do give you two. I think what's fascinating about drinking a vintage port and a Coglieta port from the same vintage is that they give you two different windows into what that vintage was all about. It's two different understandings of what the 2000 year could give in terms of sensory pleasure. And they're different pleasures because of the way they've aged. And for me, that's the fun. Just to have those two glasses in front of you and compare, it's enjoyable just to have one of either, but to have them both is just great.
It turns out that Noval has a long history in both styles, which isn't true for everybody. Because, you know, Sometimes certain houses really emphasize their tawny and certain houses really emphasize their vintage, but Noval has a long track record with both.
Yeah, Noval has always had a foot in both camps in that respect. Noval has made some of the legendary vintage ports of the past. The 1931 vintage port and the 1931 National were probably the most famous of all of those. But at the same time, Noval was laying down ports consistently to make old Coglieta ports. And I think Noval has always had this status of, traditionally the image was that the British-based houses were more specialized in vintage and perhaps the Portuguese were more specialized in tawnies. It's very much a simplification because it was never quite so clear-cut as that either way. But if you accept the simplification just for the sake of argument, Noval was always the great Portuguese house that was accepted in the traditional markets for the Anglo-Saxon markets for great vintage port, but also carried on making great tawny port. So Noval had a foot in both camps, although it's very much a Portuguese port house.
You also make the Nacional port. Yep. And what is the tradition of that? And what exactly is that?
Nacional is, we're very lucky to have it. There's just this one small parcel of Nacional in the whole of the Douro Valley. It's just 2 hectares, just slightly under 5 acres of vines at the heart of the Quinta Noval vineyard. And what's special about Nacional is that in this very small parcel, ungrafted vines survive and thrive. And for some reason, we really don't know why, in that little parcel, they survive. So the result is grapes that are very different to what we grow in the rest of the vineyard. The vines are less vigorous. They produce fewer bunches, smaller grapes, lower yields, and always something very different to what we get from the rest of the vineyard. Not always better. There are some years where the Nacional does not produce something particularly great, but when it does produce something great, it is absolutely extraordinary. And I think when you compare a Nacional and a Quinta Noval vintage from the same year, Quinta Noval vintage is one of the great vintage ports of all, very beautiful, but the Nacional has something else. It has an extra dimension, an extraordinary power and youth and tannic structure to it. Nacional has an almost eternal youth to it. You can taste a Nacional that's 50 years old, and people who are really good port tasters who probably might never have tasted it will guess it to be a wine that's 20 years old. It's just different. So for us, a huge privilege and pleasure to have this small parcel of vineyard to look after, which, again, for me, confirms something very important about wine. In the same way that making wine in lagars is a proof of the importance of the vineyard, because lagars are not a technological way to make wine. The Nacional also, for me, illustrates the idea that a great wine is great because of the place it comes from and because of the particular circumstances of the year in which the grapes grew, and not because of anything particularly clever that we do. Because I've been looking after Noval now for nearly 23 years, and some years we've had some very great Nationals, and I love those wines, and I'm very proud to have been there while they happened. I certainly don't think that it's because of us that they are great, because if that were so, we'd have been able to do it every year, and we haven't. We had a period from 2004 to 2011 where we didn't make a single Nationale. And, you know, every year it was, the grapes were good, they made a very good wine, but it wasn't the great thrilling thing that we know to be the Nationale. And I decided when I took over at Noval that I would never declare a Nationale vintage unless I was convinced that it was absolutely outstanding and extraordinary. So 2005, 6, 7, 8, 9, 10, there was no Nationale at all. If it was all about us being brilliant winemakers, we might have made a bit of an effort and tried to make one. But it's not like that. When the Nationale decides to be great, it just decides to be great. And we have to look after the vineyard. We have to look after the grapes. We have to accompany it. But it really, it marches to its own drum. But when it's great, it's really great.
So are there certain things that the vintages that have been declared as Nationale have in common? I mean, is it better in warm years? Is it better in cooler years? Is it?
No, I really don't think that I could say that there were years where I'd be walking around the vineyard in the beginning of September and think, yeah, this is going to be a great Nationale year. No, it isn't like that. And it's just mysterious. We taste immediately after the harvest, when it's all over. Antonio Grelis and I, we do our first tasting completely blind of all the different lots of wine, and there'll probably be about 50 different lots of Lagar-made port with vintage potential. And there are some years where you're just going down the line and you stop at one wine and you think, I know what that is. And that's when the Nationale is great. But no, there isn't a profile. It follows its own rhythm.
And is it more of a sandier parcel, or?
You might think that was the case because, you know, obviously the phylloxera, you know, we know does not thrive in sandy soils, but actually it's schist as rock. And we truly don't know. We have tried to plant ungrafted vines in other parts of Quinta de Noval, and all I can say is it didn't work. So I think that you probably you could say that it's a very fragile survival. I'm not implying that by the way, that the vines date from before 1860, because that's not true. When I say survival, they are ungrafted vines, but the average age is about 45 years. And when one dies, we replant it. But it's fragile in the sense that, you know, phylloxera could arrive there any time. And so this story, which is a wonderful story, producing one of the most magical great wines of the world, it could end at any time. I hope it's not going to end ever, and I hope certainly not that it'll end on my watch, but it could happen. There is no natural protection of that parcel against phylloxera. For some reason, it works, and long may it continue to do so.
So one of the other things about Noval is that you do make a dry red table wine.
Yep.
Are those generally from the same vintages as declared from the house, or how does it carry through? I mean, what do you see when you make a dry red table wine from the same year that you make a Collieta port from and that you also make a vintage port from?
It does tend to be the case, but it's not always the case that if it's a very good year for vintage port, it can be a very good year for red wines as well. But it isn't always the case. So for example, recently, 2014 was an absolutely fantastic year for the red wines, and we're not going to be making a vintage port from 2014, and we haven't yet decided about a Collieta. You know, there are some years which are, you could say, oh, this was really good for the table wines, perhaps not so favorable for the ports. You have other years where you say, oh, it's more the port year, and then there are some years where it's both. So, you know, the Douro is endlessly surprising, and it refuses always to be categorized, and you just have to keep an open mind and accept that it's like that.
What's been the learning curve on the still red? Because it's been a shorter history.
very short history. And, you know, the first red wine that we produced at Quinton Naval was 2004 vintage. That was after many years of experiments in the 1990s. But we produced our 2004 vintage. At the moment, we're selling our 11s and 12s on the market. So, you know, that's a very, very short curve compared to the other wines of Naval, which have been going on for centuries and certainly decades in terms of the wines that people know today. I think that we're at the beginning. We're on a very sharp upward incline of learning. When I do a vertical today, going back from the wines we've just made, the 2015s and 14s, which aren't in bottle yet, but we can taste them, and we go back to the 2004s, it's very clear that the quality of what's been made in recent years is some considerable steps up of what we were making in the beginning. But we were very proud and happy with what we were making in the beginning. And I'm fairly sure that in another 10 to 15 years, we'll do the same thing again and we'll feel the same way in relation to today. I think we're learning every year. We know we have in our hands one of the great vineyard terroirs of the world. We know that historically it's been capable of making one of the great wines of the world in vintage ports. And we're just beginning to discover how to unlock the quality potential of that terroir in unfortified red and indeed white wines. And, you know, while I'm thrilled with what's happening, what's happened so far and what's happening recently, the thing that excites me the most is where we're going.
Was there any history there of still red that was maybe just drunk there?
Yeah, there was always a bit of that, but you know, it wasn't taken very seriously, and it was really a red wine made for the consumption of the people working at the vineyard, I think it took quite a lot of experimentation and new approaches to winemaking to arrive at the quality that's being made in the Douro Valley today. There weren't too many accidental very good red wines from that period. There were one or two people, you know, Barcavelia was the exception, with Ferreira making a very grand Douro red for a very long time, but there weren't very many.
And which do you pick first? Do you usually pick the red wine grapes for the still wine first or the port?
There's no rule about it, but it would tend to be the red wine grapes first because you don't want them to be much more than 14 degrees of potential alcohol, 14 and a half or thereabouts. Whereas with port, it doesn't really matter if they get, you know, extremely ripe, as long as they retain all their balance and freshness. So you can harvest port wines to make port at 15 or 16, and it's not a problem. You just add a little bit less alcohol. So the tendency would be to pick the red wines first, but it's not always the case. There are certain grape varieties that ripen much later. And so Tinto Caun, which is it's a lovely grape variety, one that we take very seriously both for port and red wine at Naval, it ripens about 5 weeks later than the earliest ripening grapes. So if you're going to make red wine with Tinto Caun, you would harvest it after a lot of the port's been harvested.
One thing that must be true with port is that with a 20-year period, it's almost like you're just starting to get back some of the results, right? You know,
yes.
Because it's on a longer time frame of aging. So
yes.
Having that be the case now, what's the plan for the next 20 years? I mean, what have you learned that's going to be important for the next two decades?
What I've learned is that we've just learned a bit, and we haven't learned at all. And I would say the most important thing is the awareness that we've just still got a whole lot more to discover. I think that if you ever felt, I've got the hang of this now, I know how to make port, I know how to make red wine, and there's not much else to learn about this business. If you ever felt like that, then you should just get out and go and do something else. And we're constantly questioning everything we do. So I've learnt over the last 22 years that you can make progress. I've learnt that it's sometimes hit and miss, and it's not always a linear progress. But above all, I've learnt that if you keep questioning everything, if you keep pursuing the dream of trying to make the most beautiful wine that your vineyard can make in any given year, as long as you keep that aim in front of you and trying to do everything you possibly can to get there, there's a chance that progressively over the years you may improve.
Christian Seely was left alone one day at Quinton Naval, and he rather liked it. Thank you very much for being here today.
Thanks a lot.
Christian Seely is the managing director of the wine properties of AXA.
All Drink to That is hosted and produced by myself, Levy Dalton. Aaron Scala has contributed original pieces. Editorial assistance has been provided by Bill Kimsey. The show music was performed and composed by Rob Moose and Thomas Bartlett. Show artwork by Alicia Tenoyan. T-shirts, sweatshirts, coffee mugs, and so much more, including show stickers, notebooks, and even gift wrap, are available for sale if you check the show website, alldrinktothatpod.com. That's I-L-L, drinktothatpod.com, which is the same place you'd go to sign up for our email list or to make one of the crucially important donations that help keep this show operating. You can donate from anywhere using PayPal or Stripe on the show website. Remember to hit subscribe or to follow this show in your favorite podcast app, please. That's super important to see every episode. And thank you for listening.